This is a Toronto Public Library broadcast.
Welcome to Live Mic, the best of TPL conversations. Today's episode features Jennifer Egan chatting with journalist Garvia Bailey about historical fiction. Jennifer's visit from the Goon Squad won the Pulitzer Prize in 2011, and her latest, Manhattan Beach, won the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction.
I didn't think I will write historical fiction. I always start with a time and a place. Mm-hmm. With Goon Squad, it was a woman in a bathroom who sees another woman's wallet and decides to take it. That is basically what led to that entire book. And then I followed all kinds of characters and situations that led from that moment into all different times and places. With this book, I just was inclined toward New York during World War II. I didn't exactly know why. I still don't exactly know why, but I think it had a lot to do with 9/11, when New York felt like a war zone overnight. And also when I, and I think probably everyone in the world, thought about the trajectory of global American power and what this event would mean in it, to what degree this event had resulted from it. And in my mind, I thought, how did it begin? What did it feel like when that post-war American power came to be? What did it feel like during the war? Mm. So all of that led me to be really interested, I think, in New York during the war, and I just wanted to know what it felt like to be there. It was really that simple. I had to go pretty deep before I felt like I could really feel it.
Right.
I learned something really important, which is it's not enough to just know what people wore and even said and what kind of cigarettes they smoked and those kinds of things at a particular moment. That's the least of it. Because we're all in this moment now, and what we bring to it is the prism of our own pasts mm-hmm. and our shared cultural past. Mm-hmm. And that stuff is what really matters. To write about people, I had to know that. And that took a lot longer than finding out about cars and cigarettes. Something I think about a lot when I'm writing are people's habits of mind. Yeah. You know, we all think in our own ways. We organize reality in our own ways. And I need to know how my characters organize their reality. And again, that all comes down to what they come from. Mm-hmm. And especially because I not only don't I write about people I know, I seem to be unable to do it. I wish I could. So I guess I'm inventing them. It doesn't quite feel like that. It feels more like I'm discovering them. But what I found before I reached this point of synthesis or kind of deep knowledge or engagement with the period was that I felt very stiff. I felt like I couldn't really do my thing. Mm. And the result of that, it was a good analogy is trying to have a complicated conversation if you don't really know a language very well. Like I remember thinking when I was a student in Italy, you know, in Italian, I'm actually dumb. I mean, how do you define intelligence? I can't express complex ideas.
Right.
Therefore, it's as if I didn't have them.
Right.
I don't understand things very well. I can't get nuances. Like, who would want to talk to me?
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of, I was sort of writing the equivalent of that way for a while. And I thought, who would want to read this? I mean, I did a lot of research before I even started writing, and that was kind of experiential. Mm. I talked to a lot of people, luckily, because they were already quite mm-hmm. elderly, some of them. I had some adventures. I went to a reunion of Army divers and got to wear the Mark V diving costume and other things like that. And then once I sat down to write, since I don't have a story before I start, at that point I began to get a sense of the story, and then that led to lots of research in the moment. So the research was always fun, and I think that was a crucial element of all this. Because first of all, I was doing something that I enjoyed, which was great. Second of all, a lot of it was so arcane that the fact that it felt important seemed like a good sign. I mean, if I could be on the elliptical machine at Crunch Gym reading a detailed pamphlet called How to Abandon Ship, which meant, and they didn't mean that metaphorically.
No, it was real.
This was about
real
what to do.
Yeah.
Then I thought, well, this has to be leading somewhere because this mm-hmm. is not something I'm going to be using in my daily life. Mm-hmm. And so that was very heartening. And then I also even enjoyed it so much at times and felt that the experiences I had were so valuable and the people I got to talk to were so marvelous that I would think, you know, even if it goes nowhere, okay, so I spent a few years, you know, contributing to an oral history project,
right,
being on the advisory board of a new museum at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. You know, there are worse ways I could have spent my time.
And all of these things happened. I mean, this was the first time, and I wanted to bring this up to you, exactly this, because there's a couple of names that popped up in getting ready to speak to you that now I've kind of gone down a rabbit hole trying to find out a little bit more about them, including Andrea Motley Crabtree.
Oh, she's
who
wonderful.
Was the first diver, female diver, in the U.S. Army. And I saw her name and I thought, I need to know a little bit more about her. And I started to look at pictures of her. Not only that, she's an African-American woman. So even on top of that, I just felt like this is fascinating. And you got to sit down and talk to her in researching for Anna's life.
Yes, and in fact, I've never met her. I want to meet her, and I think we have to find
Can
a way.
Can I come?
That would be fun.
Okay.
She's so great. I've probably spent a total of 10 hours on the phone with this woman.
Yeah.
I mean, she's really great. And what was so wonderful about her was that, she is a joyful, articulate, wonderful person, but her story is a sad story. I mean, she was essentially driven out of diving by sexism.
Right.
And what's interesting is, as you say, she's African American. I don't know if the issue of race came up once in discussing why her diving career didn't work out. Hmm. It was all about being female, which was very interesting. The men really, really didn't want her there. And ultimately, she had to go. I mean, she was in a position where she couldn't get promoted anymore, so she moved into another part of the Army and ultimately became, you know, like a commercial diver and did different things. She's not bitter, but sexism drove her out. And it's interesting, she talked about how, when she read the book, and she's been really supportive and sweet, but she said, you made it too easy on her, which was amazing because it's not like it's easy
for
Anna.
It was not easy for Anna.
But I think that the reason that she said that is Anna is able to succeed in some measure, and Andrea was not.
Also, I want to ask you about Lucille Culkin.
Oh, yes,
who is another
kind of a guardian angel.
So tell me about Lucille, and because a lot of this story, I mean, you talk about the oral history project that you worked on around the naval yards, and Lucille was, you really dug into her life as well, and she shared quite a bit.
I did. Well, Lucille, I keep wanting to say I met her, but I can't say that because I was reading her letters. That was long before I spoke to Andrea or any of that. I had just gotten interested in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I wanted to try to learn what it was like to work there. So at the Brooklyn Historical Society, there was this cache of letters written from Lucille Culkin to her husband, Al. They met at the Navy Yard. He was a machinist, and she was a ship fitter. They married precipitously. In her letter, she called it from maidenhood to marriage in 3 easy months.
Oh, goodness.
He joined the Navy, and then he wrote letters to her as well, but there aren't as many of those. And she wrote passionate, garrulous, informative. I mean, you couldn't ask for better letters. And she adored him so much. And you know, they're handwritten, so I really felt like I was sort of in her mind.
Yeah.
And there was a very kind of profound moment that occurred, which was that she was writing about, she'd had a dream that they'd had a son, and she sort of fantasized for a minute and said, oh, Butch, that's what she called him, you know, what'll happen after the war, you know, how many kids will we have, where will we live, and I thought, I'd love to know the answers to those questions. I wonder if there's a way to find her or talk to her. So I walked straight over to the computer within a minute of reading this letter, and I Googled her name, and I was reading her obituary. And it was really chilling to go from this youthful, handwritten speculation about her future to a newspaper obituary that briefly said, you know, dove at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, had 2 daughters, survived by her husband, Al, done. And so I sat there, and I felt sort of frozen. And then I finally went back to the letters, but for a while it wasn't the same to know how the story would end,
right.
and to feel that I knew and she didn't. It was really eerie. Anyway, I wrote an essay about that whole experience because then she joined Al, and then the letters stopped, and I thought, oh no, why isn't she writing
next?
More?
Yes,
she had no reason to write. They were together. So I thought, I wish I could do something more about this, but I had no ideas. So I wrote an essay about how much it felt like a friendship. Yeah. In a way, it felt like my conversations with Andrea, because I never met her, and her voice is in my head, too. So anyway, I published this essay in a book of essays about Brooklyn, and about 6 or 7 weeks later, I got an email on my public email address, and the subject line was, I am Lucy's daughter. Amazing. So she had two daughters, as I knew from the obituary. Her Al was still alive, and this was in 2008, and we all went to the Navy Yard together. And it was amazing, and I felt a little shy around Al, because I knew a lot about him. But, you know, to be there with him, and he went back into the machine shop where he had not been since the war, which was now empty of machines. It just had a big wind blowing through it, and he looked around very quietly with his walker. Mm. So these were the kinds of experiences that made me feel like I was ahead no matter what the result. I will say that the characters in my fiction are the hardest thing for me to explain. And it does feel a bit mysterious. It feels like it's coming from outside me. I tend to have a more psychological view of things, so I feel like I'm accessing my unconscious or some part of my imagination that I can't call to mind when I just sit down and think. The way I get to my characters is that I just start writing, and I write a first draft by hand. So in Goon Squad, that was I wrote that in smaller pieces, but the process is exactly the same. I knew that I was going to be writing about, I had a sense of a female who would be working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I knew that I had a sort of underworld figure who would play some kind of role, but I didn't know what. And I didn't really know that Anna's father would be important at all. I kind of thought he would just be absent. But then when I sat down to write after those 7 years of kind of meandering around while writing other books and doing this kind of fun research, I found myself writing about all of them meeting on a beach during the Depression. And that was, I was not expecting that. I had never heard of Manhattan Beach, the New York one. I just knew from my reading at the Brooklyn Historical Society that Coney Island had once had lots of fancy houses, that it was like an exclusive resort area before the subway came. And then, of course, the fancy people were like, oh, look at all these normal people. We got to get out of here. So I was conjuring, you know, a beautiful house somewhere in that area. Mm. I wasn't quite sure where. And you know, this triad of important characters kind of appeared, and in some ways had their personalities right from the start. I mean, it took a while to get to know them. I think one of the things that was important for me to discover about Anna, and I don't think this is really giving too much away, is that when we do meet her again a few chapters in and she is working at the Navy Yard, she's working in a world where girls are considered to be either good or bad.
That's right.
And she's only 19, which of course in our world seems very young, almost like a kid. But at that time really was not. I mean, girls routinely got married at that age. You were considered an adult at 19. Anna is really not innocent. You know, she has a kind of secret past that was important for me to discover, and that made her more interesting to write about. So, of course, I have this idea that I never write about my own life. See how I never do? but I didn't really know it. And in fact, the biography is quite different. Eddie, Anna's father, does not have a drinking problem. She has a younger sister who's severely disabled, and that is really the part of the family life that is so problematic. I guess the other thing I would say is I have two kids, who are 14 and 16, two sons. And I think in a way, part of what the book is about is the difficulty of letting go of your children.
For sure.
The difficulty of letting them be their own people. And I was writing that before I actually had to confront it in my own life, but I am amazed at how hard I find that. Yeah. I don't want to let them grow up. I didn't get that that would have to happen. So I feel like that was also a story I was telling a little bit before I really had occasion to know it firsthand. But as I struggled with this, I thought, huh, it's so interesting how there are a lot of parallels here between my situation and Eddie's. And that's the kind of scrambling that I do like to do. I there's no way I could write a story about a mother trying to separate from her children. It's way too close to me. But somehow a father, you know, at that time, in such different circumstances, felt far away enough, I think, that I could manage it. I mean, it's amazing how willing people are to tell their stories to someone who's interested. So I feel like it's a delicious job. And I will say, I don't know if I could have acquired the technical knowledge or had the confidence, really, to acquire knowledge in so many areas that I really had to be fairly conversant in to write this. The Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is a place with its own storied history dating back to the Revolutionary War, deep sea diving in the 1930s and 40s, and then also the Merchant Marine, which is, you know, I mean, nautical matters are, I mean, there are people who know a lot about that stuff. Mm-hmm. It has its own language and history, and fascinating wartime history, actually, in America. The Merchant Marine lost more men, I think it was only men, per capita, proportionately than any of the other armed services. They died in droves. Because the U-boats would blow up merchant ships. It was easy to do because they were poorly armed. And until sonar was better developed and convoy shipping became more common, it was actually really easy. And they would prevent really valuable stuff from getting where it needed to go, like tanks and you know, planes and weaponry. So it was actually a really interesting world to get into. And once again, you know, immersing myself involved going to a Liberty ship, one of two functional Liberty ships that still exists in the U.S. Liberty ships were mass-produced cargo ships. I feel like maybe Canada built them too. I'm not sure. But they were welded rather than riveted, which meant that they could be, they were identical. I mean, they really were mass-produced. And in fact, the record was an entire ship, one of them was built in 4.5 days.
Wow.
Which is kind of incredible when you look at these things. I think it was 2,710 in total that we built. So basically, as fast as the Germans could blow these ships up,
we were building.
We just kept sending more out.
Wow.
And on this Liberty ship in San Francisco are mariners who sailed during World War II. And they're incredible. It's amazing to talk to them. My favorite is a gentleman named Norm Schoenstein, who was an engineering officer, and he was climbing up and down these catwalks. It's a long way down into the engine room of a Liberty ship. And we spent hours talking, and he gave me all kinds of demonstrations and told funny stories. He was 93 then.
Wow.
Working on the ship several days a week. We're in touch a lot now by email, but he complained after his 95th birthday a few months ago that they won't let him drive at night anymore.
Live Mike is produced by the Toronto Public Library. Gregory McCormick is the executive producer. This episode is produced by Natalie Curtis, with technical production by Michelle DeMarco, communications support from Sumaya Ahmed and Mabel Ho, and live AV by Jennifer Casper and Mesfin Basisu. Music is by Jairus Khan, and I'm George Panayotu. Thanks so much for listening.